This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, The Exchange brings you the best of 2014, five favorite shows chosen by listeners and staff. The program we're about to hear is from June of this year on how we talk about race. Admittedly, the state of race relations and conversations about it seem more fraught now, with the killings by police of black suspects in several states, street protests in response, and then just before Christmas, the shooting deaths of two New York City police officers. Still, the themes brought up in this earlier conversation seem to resonate, a discussion that first stemmed from outrage over racist comments by Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling in April. And then just 3 weeks later, a similar story erupting in New Hampshire, when, at a local restaurant, Wolfboro Police Commissioner Robert Copeland was overheard using a racial slur to describe the president. Today in The Exchange, our Best of 2014 series continues with our conversation on how we talk about race. We have three guests in studio. With us is Ava Castillo, coordinator for the New Hampshire Alliance for Immigrants and Refugees and member of the Manchester Police Commission. Ava, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us is Loretta Carl Brady, associate professor of psychology at St. Anselm College, diversity columnist for New Hampshire Business Review. Loretta's consulting firm is BDS Insight, which focuses on culture, crisis, and conflict management. Loretta, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Dottie Morris, chief officer of diversity and multiculturalism at Keene State and hero for justice of the New Hampshire YWCA. Dottie, thanks for making the trip from Keene, and good to see you again.
Thank you very much.
Well, and the Washington Post, all of you called this Donald Sterling case a teachable moment in terms of sparking a conversation about race. What do you think, Dottie? What's teachable about this?
Well, I think that we live in a culture of denial around race and how race matters. And I think that this has given us an opportunity to really examine how race matters in this culture. And I think that for so long, we've lived with that denial that it's become like a forbidden topic. And the more something is forbidden, the more we have some weird things that might surface. So with these comments of our people in positions of power making these comments, I think that it's given us an opportunity to kind of regroup and let's really talk about what race is and how this entire country was built on kind of a racist premises. So this gives us an opportunity to really talk about that.
Give me a little more, please, Dottie, on this denial that you talk about.
Well, I think that it's denied because once we have to come to terms with how race and race matters, because most people say, well, race is a social construct. So this whole idea that race is only given meaning by the way that a society gives it meaning. And so in the United States, we have given race a meaning, but we don't want to talk about what that meaning is all about. That, you know, when we think about colonization related to Native Americans, when we talk about the enslavement of people of African descent, when we talk about how we brought in, you know, Asian, specifically Chinese people to build a railroad, and all of the exploitative kinds of things that have occurred as a result of this thing called race. And so as a result of that, if we have to admit that those things happen, it kind of creates a different story about this country as opposed to the rugged individualists. It creates this other story of people who were in positions of power who were exploitative. And so the myth of these wonderful people coming to this country and just settling and just working, it would be another story, another narrative that we'll have to come to terms with. And I think that once we come to terms with the alternative narrative, I think that we'll be able to work through some of the issues that we have that continues to be rooted in those initial kinds of experiences that we had here as a country.
What do you think, Ava, even though a lot of people were offended by Sterling and Copeland, a teachable moment?
I think that just the fact that we're talking about it, you know, makes a big difference. People tend to get very defensive every time that you mention race. And if they feel, even if you're not referring to them directly, my experience with working with the Immigrant Integration Initiative here in New Hampshire is every time that we say yes, but there is some type of disparity here, systematic, that leaves people out of it, colored people out of the systems, they feel the need to defend themselves like we're attacking them personally. So it's a very sensitive touch, and until people learn to lower those defenses and to just listen without feeling personally attacked, and without having that need to defend, we're never going to make any difference and we're not going to make any changes. So we need to keep talking about it in spite of how uncomfortable some people might feel about it.
What do you think about Dottie's comment about denial? You know, some people might say, hey, we're beyond this, you know, racist past. We've got a black president, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, but those are usually the white people that think that way. We're beyond that in their mind. They think they're beyond that, but they need to put themselves in our shoes. And I understand people only have their own frame of reference to work from. You know, I'm married to a mainstream white American person, and he grew up here with open horizons. So we come here to this country, we don't only have a door, we have 50 doors behind, and we have gatekeepers, and we have people holding the door against us. So, you know, he says, why do you feel that way? Well, I feel that way because I experienced that. Your experience is different, that's okay, you know, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
What's teachable for you, Loretta, from all this?
Well, Ava, your point earlier that, the defensiveness with which we enter these kinds of conversations is really striking because, you know, on one hand, I agree that we need to remember everyone's frame is different and we need to engage in these conversations in a way that allows us to listen. At the same time, we also have to learn how to be comfortable with discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to learn how to understand that sometimes the conversations we're having actually are personal. And some of that personal reference is about us and the stuff that we're bringing to the conversation. But some of it is that we are receiving a message that no one has actually been able to hear from the person that we're speaking with. So the example would be if you're having a conversation with somebody who has a different background than you and you're seeing them kind of get riled and passionate about the point that they're trying to make. You know, some of that is about maybe the reaction you've had or something you've said or done, but some of it is also you're hearing something that really needs to be heard, both from their perspective, but maybe from the community that they are from or the experience that they represent. So there's many layers to those kinds of conversations. I do think it's a teachable moment if we choose to accept it as that. It's also, I think, very easy, particularly with some of the tabloid-style treatment of these headlines, for it to be a very something very divorced from our experience. Oh, that's them. Oh, they've been caught out of turn. But that's not really what it's really like.
I want to pick up what you said, Loretta, on if we choose to accept it as a teachable moment. Some people have said in the weeks since all this happened with both Sterling and then later Copeland here in New Hampshire, that we feel like justice was served, you know, they're bad, they're naughty, they were dismissed, and, you know, we're all good now.
Yeah, $2 billion dollars richer. Yeah, really punished. I mean, just heart-wrenching, the pain that caused. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be so irreverent, but I do think that there is,
you know, we kind of pat ourselves on the back and say, okay,
really
we were mad about
that. There was a just outcome in some respects. But at the same time, recognize that those are just two examples And those are two examples that happened to be publicized.
Right.
And because they were publicized, there was a response. Those examples exist every hour, every minute, and there's no publicity, and there's often no consequence.
Right.
Let me invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're talking about why it's so hard to talk about race, how we talk about this in 2014. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Sean's calling from Keene. Hi, Sean. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I appreciate getting on.
Sure.
The term the tyranny of the majority comes to mind here. While I feel as though the comments made by both Mr. Sterling and the gentleman from New Hampshire are deplorable, and I couldn't disagree with them more wholeheartedly. I still feel as though they have the right to say that. That's what our freedom of speech constitutional right is. And whether we agree or disagree with what they have to say, how can you punish both punitive and, you know, potentially criminally, these people that are just exercising their constitutional freedom of speech.
Sean, thank you very much, for calling in. And Dottie, this definitely came up after the days concerning Mr. Copeland, and some people said, yes, I deplore, like Sean, what he said, but it was a private conversation with a friend at a restaurant, overheard and reported by a local woman. How do you feel about this free speech argument, Dottie?
That's the complexity of all of this, because, you know, sometimes I might have the unpopular kind of narrative, and I want it to be heard. One of the things that I think about often is how language informs behavior. And if I'm in a position of power and I'm using certain language, it will have an impact on my behavior. And so when people in positions of power, including chief of police or owners of a sporting team or anyone with power, politicians, they use certain language, and that language, it has an impact on how they behave, how they vote, how they treat their employees, how they might profile certain people. So if you're using that language, because, I mean, it's very clear that language is always at the beginning of any type of atrocity, where we start to relabel people, we start to dehumanize people, and it's not far from the language to the kind of subsequent behavior.
Okay, a lot more to unravel there. We'll take a short break and I'll get your thoughts. We'll also hear from you at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More conversation about race after a short break. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how do we talk about race in 2014? Join us with your thoughts. Is the public outcry over recent comments made by Donald Sterling and Robert Copeland, is that kind of outrage enough? Is it too much? One of our callers has raised the free speech issue. What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. All one word. And just before the break, Dottie Morris, you were following up with Sean in Keene. And Sean, thank you very much for calling. He was saying he opposed what the Wolfboro Police Commissioner said, but he did feel like it was a private conversation. And under the First Amendment, the guy had, you know, the right to say what he wanted. Go ahead, Dottie, finish up. And then I definitely want to hear from Loretta and Ava.
And the other thing that when you are a public citizen and you say something privately, especially in a public place, you have to be mindful that it could be overheard by other people. So going back to my original point about how behavior, language informs behavior, I think that the other thing that makes it difficult is that it's the way that we approach kind of coming up with consequences for people, as opposed to bring them into the conversation, we push them out of it. And so they become representative of all the things that we don't like. And so because these people were overt with their language and overt with their actions, then we can basically say, okay, if we could just punish them, we're done, as opposed to engaging in kind of a restorative process to have conversations about what does it mean that you did use that language? How might that have an impact on your behavior? And I think that we don't do that because it's all about being punitive. And I think that in order for us to get over some of these things, we have to start having different ways of responding to those types of actions that people might have that are bias related.
Now, that's really interesting. So instead of just saying, you're bad, go away, engage with that person.
That's my opinion. And I think that that's the only way that we'll be able to work through this. Because I don't know about you, but if I feel attacked, even if I've said something inappropriate, and I feel attacked, what I'm going to do is attack back. And I think that that's where we've come to this weird kind of place in this country where we're just kind of fighting over and over and over again. So we're replaying some of the same types the script. It's almost like a script that we have, that if someone says something, so just for example, Justin Bieber just said some things, and so now people are saying, don't play his music on the radio. I don't like the things that he had to say, but I think that engaging with him in a different way could really have an impact on how young people think about race in this country.
I want to ask you also, both of you, Ava, how about you first? This idea that Sean raises that a lot of other people have raised that, yeah, it's reprehensible what Mr. Copeland said, but he's got the right to say it.
Yeah, I think he has the right to say it, but you also have to be mindful of your position as a leader. You know, like I am a police commissioner and I'm an activist too. So I have to be mindful that my actions as a member of the police commission could result in embarrassment to the police that I so proudly represent. So I have to be very careful, and I hold myself to a higher standard than I would if I were not part of the commission itself. You know, as a citizen, as a private citizen, you can do and say whatever, but we're not all Archie Bunkers. And if we're in a public position and holding an office, we should really be very mindful of how our actions affect the people that we're representing.
So First Amendment's a little different, you're saying, Ava, for someone who's in a position of power, like a Wolfboro police commissioner, versus some random, you know, Joe or Jane who walks into that diner and starts spouting racist comments about the president.
At the minimum, you should be very mindful of how far your rights, you exercise that right, yes.
Here's another shade of that same question for you, Loretta. You know, it's also been brought up that, boy, 20 years ago, you didn't have Twitter, you didn't have, you know, Facebook. Things just didn't get amplified to the degree that they get amplified now. I wonder how much you think that is playing into this.
Are you asking me that because I have 3 Twitter profiles?
just 3?
Yeah, I know, right? Why stop there? In more serious, one thing I do want to respond in Sean's question regarding the free speech statement. This comes up quite a bit when we are engaged in conversations about cross-cultural dialogue. And, you know, I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I can't actually speak to this with any authority. But, you know, free speech does have limits. And to hold that value is not to say that there aren't going to be consequences for speech, right? So there's one thing to sort of be able to speak one's mind and say one's opinion, but it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be consequences. And I understand that phrase, tyranny of the majority. I hear that perspective.
That's what Sean said, yeah.
Yeah, Sean, the caller earlier, had mentioned that. And I get that, but, you know, both of these men are public figures. And while their statements might have been said in a private conversation, and overheard or deliberately taped, they were themselves holding a very powerful position. Mm-hmm. And the organizations that they represented had every right to respond to that, I think.
So you can say what you want, but recognize that it mm-hmm. could get you into trouble, especially in today's
One
era
where
everything's... One
of my children can tell me exactly what they think. They might be sent to their room. but to your question, you know, Dottie raised earlier this idea that maybe a more useful response to some of these experiences would be rather than alienating the person who said something that the majority doesn't agree with, to try and bring them in and engage them in a meaningful way. And there's a story that's kind of playing out right now. It isn't about race, but it is about gender. And it there was a – speaking of social media, there was a conference going on in Berlin, Germany, and a woman in the crowd took a picture of a slide that was comparing something called Maven, this computer application, to the presenter's girlfriend, and said that it looked really great, but this product doesn't play nicely with others, and it always complains about things that he's doing when he's trying to interact with it. And these very kind of sexist comparisons. And the icon on the slide was this product with a ponytail. And the young woman in the crowd, actually, I don't know if she's young or old, but she took a picture and tweeted, "Really? Who writes this stuff?" And within, of course, people respond to that, and there was an outrage, justly so, I think. And by the end of the day, the owner of the company that the man who had presented, he issued a statement. He wrote a blog post. He said, "We take responsibility for this. We're not sure how that material made it into the presentation. We're going to look at our internal process, and we're also going to work with that presenter because we think he's a valuable team member. And we think that we can all learn from this."
That's the dialogue that
Dottie's talking about. That's the dialogue
that
Dottie talked about. And, within that sphere, that I'm not sure what the broader reaction is going to be. It's, like I said, it was like 8 hours ago that this was all unfolding. But I do think social media plays a role both in how this the alarms spread and in how people might choose to respond.
Okay. And speaking of the dialogue, I want to talk with all of you in a moment about Mark Cuban, because he tried to engage in a dialogue, got praise on one side, got pilloried on the other. But let's go back to our listeners, because they want to join this conversation too. Our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Another keen caller, Jody this time. Hi, Jody. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Well, thank you so much. My comment is that I think that part of this is generational. It was interesting for me. I have a 30-year-old son who lives in California, and he's lived in communal housing since he graduated from college. When he recently showed me the photo of his current housemates, he pointed out that who was clearly an African American to me, he said, "Oh, and this guy is the guy, and John is the guy in the blue shirt." And I thought, yeah, he is the guy in the blue shirt, and that the distinctive feature for me was the color of his face, but that my son didn't even see that. And
interesting.
I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, Jody, thank you. We did a show about a week or so, Ava, on millennials. This is the most diverse generation in America ever. Real interesting. Thanks, Jody. I wonder what you think about her comment. Is some of this stuff that we're talking about today going to go away as, new generations take our place?
I really have hopes that we do. But we,
Dottie, I can tell you don't think so. I'll get to you.
I really have hopes that we do, but we need to change the systems to educate all that diversity, because the systems are still made for and by those old people, those Archie Bunker type of people.
For themselves. Gotten into some hot water.
And Manchester has gotten in hot water. And in general, all the systems are like that. Although the kids have open minds and they've grown up exposed to diversity and treating people the same, the systems are still doing us a disservice. So we need to really acknowledge that there's a problem, acknowledge and accept that we need to change those systems to provide a good platform for all those kids that are going to be our leaders of tomorrow. And if we do not prepare them to fill up the shoes of the leaders of today, what's going to happen with our society?
So that's a conversation that needs to happen.
Yes.
That you're, again, a conversation about race. That's what we're talking about.
That's right.
That you're saying is not happening.
It's not happening.
People are papering it over.
That's right.
Dottie, you want to jump in? The millennials.
The millennials.
Hope for the future.
And I do feel very hopeful.
And you work with a lot of people.
Because I work with a lot of
them. Late teens and 20s.
And I realize that that's why I'm so excited to work with them, because they are eager to engage in these conversations. And I think that this whole idea around just because you have like multiple people represented, if you don't have those opinions integrated into the larger conversation, it's still business as usual. And so even though I might not recognize, I might just say it's the guy in the blue shirt, there's still some underlining things that are race related. So being colorblind, in quotes, I don't think that that totally represent that racism is gone, because we have the assumption that we're living in a colorblind society when race still matters. And so I think that there are some shifts, but I think that, as I brought up earlier, Justin Bieber and some of the things that he had to say.
And what did he say? I haven't heard about that.
Everything was bleeped out, but he was basically he was basically talking about a few years ago when he was 15, he used the N-word several times in a taping that he had done, and had suggested joining that he was just going to join the KKK. And it was just, again, it's one of those moments that now he's much older. He's apologizing for what he said and taking responsibility for what he said. So it's not that young people don't have it kind of internalized, because they're still getting the indirect messages about how race matters in this country. And so they get deeply rooted, and they don't know that it's having an impact on their behavior. And so part of what I always do is try to help them surface that. Where did you learn these messages about different groups of people, and how is it having an impact on your behavior? So instead of denying that race matters, I like to say, let's look at race. Let's look at gender. Let's look at sexual orientation. Let's look at all of these things and see how they inform how we develop and become the people we are, and how we interpret other people's behavior.
Well, and this gets us to a conversation about race in 2014 in New Hampshire. And Loretta, our caller's son lives in California, a very diverse state. So I wonder how the conversation is different there than in New Hampshire, which is still, 90-something percent white.
Well, I do think that New Hampshire's changing demographic, the ball's already moving. If I look at my children's school, I live in Manchester. My children attend school in Manchester. And, I went to the Memorial Day Assembly, and I grew up in this state. I'm a person of color and was born in this state. I was 23 before I met someone who wasn't a cousin that looked like me in this state. And that person was visiting from Connecticut. So my children are having a very different experience than the experience that I had growing up. But I will say that, this colorblind, and someone recently wrote a column and said, be color brave, which is, the idea that of being opposite of that. And I like that idea. I think it's great to be able to scan a picture and identify someone by the article of clothing they're wearing and not necessarily their race or ethnicity. But we don't want to forget that when they shopped for that blue shirt, they were more likely to be followed. They were more likely to be given a hard time at checkout. Made a comment about if their credit card didn't clear, all those sorts of little experiences that make up a person's day that aren't represented by the fact that they're wearing a blue shirt. So do I think our youth here in New Hampshire, who maybe haven't lived in a state that has that level of diversity that California has, do I think that they're going to see that shift? I do think experience matters.
So they're more colorblind than in California. Can we say that or not?
In New Hampshire?
No, in California.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure that colorblind is a great thing.
Right.
So yes. I'm not sure that I want to use that to describe California or not. I just think that within our state, the young people that we have entering school, entering the workforce, they probably have more diversity experience than their parents and grandparents did, I think, without a doubt. I don't necessarily think that we're any better for it yet, right? I think having more contact isn't the same as having deep relationships.
That's what you want to say.
Because I think that even in California, if we look at what happened at within the California school system, university system, I think it was last year, where a young man and was living in his residence hall, and his roommates were constantly badgering him around race. And the last thing that pushed it over the edge is that they hung a Confederate flag in the room. And this is in California about a year ago. And it was very interesting that a lot of people, again, when we're living with denial, we don't talk about what symbols mean. A lot of people didn't know the implication of hanging a Confederate flag.
Didn't know why that would be upsetting.
Why that would be upsetting to this young man. And so I think that even in New Hampshire, I've seen Confederate flags. Mm-hmm. And And then when you try to engage with the person around what that Confederate flag means, they'll go, oh, it's just, you know, I'm Harley Davis, or, you know, I'm just a rebel or whatever.
It's states' rights.
States' rights.
Right.
And then you engage. You don't have to scratch the surface very much to find out that their views are consistent with the representation of that symbol of the Confederate flag. So a lot of people at that moment in California said, even, I think it was even the president, I could be wrong, said, a president of the university said, oh, I didn't really know the symbolic meaning of that Confederate flag. And it's just like, wow. So, you know, I fault myself as an educator. We are not educating people to really understand the implications of so many historical factors that continue to have an impact. So this whole idea of legacies having a ripple effect and continuing to have an impact on how we live today.
Ava, your thoughts on New Hampshire and how the conversation might be different in the Granite State. What do you think?
Well, we're very little diversity here, but also I see the dynamics of power and white privilege. People are so reluctant to give up their power, you know, and from organizing 101 power, nobody's going to hand it to you. You have to take it. And by taking it, I don't mean going and rebelling and marching, but you know, people are so afraid of handing their power to people that don't look like them. So that's one thing. That's one other axiom that enters into the picture.
You know, when we talk about conversation, Dottie said, you know, language is so important. And Loretta said just a minute ago, she doesn't necessarily like the word colorblind.
Yeah, it's
true. What other words really get you going,
We're just
Ava?
People. Tolerance drives me crazy.
You don't like the word tolerance.
And I use a very colorful thing with preparation H, you know, so I'm not going to use it here on the radio. But you tolerate a pebble in your shoe while you can get rid of it. You know, tolerance is not good enough. I want to be accepted for who I am. I don't want to be tolerated. When you tolerate some, and people, I use that word with well-meaning. That's another thing. One more thing about what it means to the people on the other side of the fence, the people that you're trying so hard to include. But when you use the word tolerance, we really feel hurt. I really get upset because English is my second language, but I still know that tolerance is that you put up with something. I don't want people putting up with me. I want to be accepted to be fully included.
We will talk a lot more after a short break. And we'll take more of your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at why it's so difficult to talk about race in light of comments made by people like Donald Sterling and Robert Copeland. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Join us with your thoughts. Is the public outcry over these kinds of comments enough? Is it too much? What do you think? And what's missing from this conversation about race in America in 2014? The number again for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Ava Castillo, Dottie Morris, and Loretta Carl Brady. And I want to pick up on something Dottie said earlier. She's been calling for dialogue. When someone says a racist comment, don't just shut them down. Engage in a dialogue about why they feel this way. This came out most recently in comments made by Mark Cuban. He's the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. He sat down with Inc. magazine. They had a conference for entrepreneurs. And Cuban was asked about what Donald Sterling said. He talked about his own internal struggles with bigotry and prejudice. Let's hear what he said.
I know I'm prejudiced. I know I'm bigoted in a lot of different ways. You know, and I've said this before. If I see a black kid in a hoodie at night on the other side of the street, bouncing, you know, I'm probably on the same side of the street, I'm probably going to walk to the other side of the street. If I see a white guy with a shaved head and lots of tattoos, I'm going back to the other side of the street, right? If I see anybody that looks threatening, you know, probably chances are there's part of me that takes into account race and gender and age. You know, I'm prejudiced.
Again, that is Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban. And, you know, I think I'll turn to you first, Loretta. He was praised by some folks for saying, you know, hey, he's being honest. Others said, you know, kind of said, what's with the hoodie comment, and kind of criticized him for that, especially given the murder of Trayvon Martin. What's your take on this? The guy is trying to start a dialogue, but he got into some hot water for it.
I don't know that reacting to his statements is the same as hot water, right? I mean, he's still the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. He still has a television career and a speaking career. And
so he's having some...
But I think getting pushback that's what dialogue is. Mm-hmm. And he happens to have the privilege of having a microphone and often being able to convey messages in one direction. So he may or may not be as used to hearing comments back. I think he is used to hearing comments back. But, you know, in the context of the forum that he was speaking in, it might appear to other people that, oh, my goodness, you know, you can't even step a little to the left or to the right without someone, you know, calling you out on it. I think that it's important what he said. I think it's accurate. I think that we do have these implicit biases in psychology research. We talk about the implicit association test, and you can flash positive and negative words on a screen and pictures of people by gender, by race, by class, and even by age. And you do see, even in individuals who will report, I'm a very accepting, inclusive, and tolerant person, you do see that that bias comes into play, even for people of color. Right. So this is not just a white person's problem. This is a person problem. We all have biases that come from our experience, our teaching, our training, and some of them seem to be hardwired.
Hardwired. What do you mean?
I mean that when Mark Cuban was making the statement about, I see somebody who I might perceive to be a threat, I am then making calculations based on class, gender, age, race, gender, age. So the hardwired piece is that we have a brain circuit, and the amygdala is a piece of this circuit that is constantly scanning for threat. It's constantly looking. Its only job is to keep us alive. And when it gets activated, it can get activated for very legitimate threats, like, you know, maybe a cobra in our path. But it can also get activated for things that we haven't figured out yet, things that we don't have familiarity with that could be a threat, or things that we've been taught are dangerous.
Mm. What do you think, Dottie? Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish up.
Yeah, so right when up. We're, you know, I think his statements are accurate. I think we do all have biases. And, you know, living in this country, it's impossible not to have received messages about individuals who are black, and men, young men in particular, it's impossible not to have received those messages. It doesn't mean that young black men are threats. It simply means that you've lived in a society where that message has been repeatedly delivered to you.
What do you think, Dottie? So here's Mark Cuban. He's not lying. He's telling you the truth about how he feels. He's not covering up his feeling about the messages and how he reacts. What's your reaction to Mark Cuban and I don't want to say hot water, maybe, but the flashback to that.
One of the first things I thought about was a comment that a friend of mine who lives in the state of Oregon always says about herself. She says, I'm a racist in recovery. And she talks about how she literally thinks that it's a 12-step or maybe a 15-step program that you need to go through because of what you were saying, Loretta, that you're constantly bombarded with these negative messages, and those messages get connected with feeling threatened. And so therefore, when you see the object that has been constructed as dangerous, then you will, you know, cross the street, you will do all of these things. So the whole idea that he was able to articulate what's going on for him, I think that very few people can do that. So that's one way that I kind of commend him on being able to articulate that these things, that race matters, that gender matters, that hoodies matter, I guess, if they're on certain people. So we've constructed this notion that a black man in a hoodie is dangerous, or a tattooed white man is dangerous. And so I think that as we look at this, how do we unlearn those things? And I think because they've been connected with danger, that kind of makes it even more difficult to separate those kinds of situations that we find ourselves in. And then we tell ourselves these things, and then we behave by crossing the street.
Well, and getting back to, again, your call for dialogue, instead of pushing people out of the conversation and saying you're bad, you know, let's engage with them. What do you think, Dottie? Here's Mark Cuban. You know, he's trying to have a dialogue, right, and he kind of got shut down.
Well, I think that part of the reason is that he was having a dialogue, but mainly with a person interviewing him, as opposed to sitting in a room where it was a lot of give and take.
Full of either white,
right,
bald guys with tattoos or black teenagers,
right,
with hoodies.
Right. And so we would all, that's it. No, that's it. Those are the kinds of environments we have to create with a certain degree of expectation around behavior. So you would say, lay out the ground rules about how we are going to behave and relate to one another. And I think that the other thing that's so clear is that we see each other as kind of one-dimensional people. And so that if I do one thing wrong, then all about me is bad, when that could be one aspect of who I am. And I think that that's where we all fall short, because I know that I judge people based on they do one thing wrong, and it's like, okay, you know, you must be a fill in the blank. But it's not until I stop myself and say, that's one aspect of that person. So how do I compassionately connect with another aspect of them in order to resolve this kind of one area that I disagree with?
Ava, I know you want to jump in, and then I have another big question for all of you. Go
well,
ahead.
Well, I agree with this, everybody having biases and stuff. But unconsciously, I have my own biases, and I'm conscious of them, and I step out of my boundaries to connect with people that I have an extended boundary and just focus on what makes us in our commonalities, and I expand from there because I am conscious of my own biases. So I think the need for dialogue and to get people together that don't perceive to have much in common is very important, because once you start building up on what you have in common and expanding from there, that's when you can really build the bridges. If we, you know, before when I came, law enforcement in our countries are bad people. We stay away from cops because they're bad. And it was not until I came here and I built a relationship with the police officers that I learned to see things different in a different light, and that I learned to trust them, and that I learned to feel safe around them. And I have done that around with homeless people, with people that, you know, because we do not have so much race, but we have a lot of economic disparity. So we don't get together with the poor people. Mm. And so I recognize that I had that, and I have made a conscious effort to get myself out of that.
Mm. Go ahead, Loretta, and then we'll go back to our listeners.
For both Ava and Dottie, you know, what strikes me, I didn't mean to tone police you, Laura, when I said that, you know, hot water's the wrong phrase.
That's okay.
And as I'm thinking, as I'm hearing each of you speak, it strikes me that, you know, maybe what was criticized wasn't so much the comment. I think the hoodie comment probably was very evocative, and people were criticizing that. But I think what was probably really being commented on was the perhaps it came across as though, yes, I have biases and I act on them, and I'm not reflecting on that. I'm not trying to stretch myself in the way that Ava described.
That's a good point.
And I think that, you know, when I bristle, you know, I really don't. People can say a lot of things, and I will, you know, accept their humanity despite some of the things they might say. But I do really bristle when things come across as though, yes, I'm biased. These are the things that I don't agree with. This is the opinion that I hold. And I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
I'm not even open to considering another possibility. That's, and I just think, yeah, okay.
So it's not enough to say, yeah, I'm flawed.
Yeah. I
it would have been nice to have heard from him what he was going to do about those.
Right.
Point.
You know, or that the maybe we need to be prepared when we're having these public conversations to ask that follow-up question.
That's
like, how
point.
Might you challenge yourself in this
right.
way
excellent
then?
Right, excellent point. Yes.
All right. One more caller. Let's go to Michael waiting in Berlin. Hi, Michael. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Well, good morning, Laura, and good morning to you guests.
Morning.
I just wanted to give a American Indian perspective. It's not often heard on many of the programs. I taught Abenaki culture and history for a number of years here in this state, and years ago I used to travel to Kentucky and teach at the Lexington Children's Museum. The final year that I went down, they had taken out newspaper full-page ads, and when I arrived, they did several TV interviews. And the Klan, though they had not marched in Lexington in over 50 years, the night before the opening, they applied for a permit. The police told the people of Lexington, if you don't support the Klan, don't go into Lexington. And the following day, I arrived at the museum in what would have been otherwise standing room only, turned into three people.
Wow, and, what a story, Michael.
And one of the people who did attend said, doesn't it make you angry? And I said, no, I served 4 years in the military to secure their right to express themselves. I don't care for what they preach. I don't care for their views. But it is their right to do as they do. Most recently, about 4 weeks ago, I was engaged in a conversation with an individual. And I think, sadly, because our early history, particularly that of our people and Europeans, because it's not taught in a meaningful way. You know, they talk about Thanksgiving and such, but it doesn't get into the real dynamics of the clashes of our cultures.
Yeah, that's something that you were talking about earlier, Dottie. Again, people feeling defensive and not knowing the full story.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Michael, and for sharing that story. It's an eye-opener. I want to share a bunch of emails that just came in with all of you and maybe get your quick thoughts as we wrap up. Here's David who emails. He says, the First Amendment rights mentioned by a caller don't apply in these two circumstances. Sterling owned a franchise within a private organization, the NBA. Members of the NBA are well within their rights to ask a member who voices opinions like those to leave. Yeah. By the same token, the citizens of any town are within their rights, in effect, to say we don't want someone of those opinions to represent us. That gets back to your sort of, you can say what you want, perhaps, but there will be consequences, sending your kid to the room if he or she mouths off. Here's Andrew. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects us from government suppression of speech. It does not protect anyone from economic or social consequences of their speech. That's Andrew. Thank you, Andrew, for that. Here's Tracy, who says, I've always felt that, yes, while you are free to say whatever you wish, you are not free from the consequences of those words or your actions or choices, especially when you're in a powerful position in your community or state. That's from Tracy. And here's Don, who says, I feel that PC worries, politically correct worries, are driving people away from conversation rather than helping. Don says, I'm a liberal, yet I'm constantly shutting up for fear of offending the offendable. What do you folks think about this? You want to jump on that first, Dottie?
Oh, Loretta looks like she wants to jump.
Loretta,
in.
Go ahead.
She was sitting on the edge of her seat.
The gentleman's name there?
This is Don.
Yeah. Don,
and let me just
okay
add in
to
one,
be uncomfortable.
And let me add one quick thing, too. We talked about the Copeland thing on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup a couple weeks ago. And somebody called and said, hey, it's offensive and it's terrible. And you know, he shouldn't have said that. And I asked the guy, I said, well, it was a private conversation, caller. You know, what do you think about that? And he said what he thought. And a lot of listeners got mad, and they said that I was taking, you know, Copeland's point of view, and how could I do that just by trying to open up the dialogue and look at all different points of view that might be out there. So people are very sensitive about this. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, your thoughts, Loretta.
You know, I think individuals who are liberal and who identify themselves as progressive, they can be wrong. they can be messy in their language. They can be mistaken in their assumptions. And I would say that if you're finding yourself in conversations where you'd like to offer something, but you're feeling you're silencing yourself because you don't want to, you know, make anyone upset, I think you have to know the context. You have to know the relationships that you're talking about here, who's in the room with you. And also, it's okay to be uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable all the time. Mm-hmm. Enjoy it.
Right.
Be brave. Yeah. You know, if we're really going to come to terms with these types of issues, we need to be willing to be brave and accept that we might be wrong and mm-hmm. people might respond to that. And that's their experience. And that's part of having these conversations.
I guess the tough thing today is if you're wrong, it isn't just you and your friend talking. It's you and the Twitterverse and, you know, all
and
over
that's,
everything.
And that's my point about knowing who's in the room with you. You know, and what the context is. Right. And it's, you know, maybe not at the bus stop, you know, before an interview. Maybe it's, you know, over your dining room table.
Do you want to jump in super quick there, Dottie?
Well, the only thing I was about to say is this whole idea around PC. And I think that oftentimes it's that you want to be perfect. And so you project it on, you put it onto the other person by saying, well, I don't want to say this because I might offend you. And in saying that, that shows that you think you have a lot of power over me. Mm-hmm. And so the whole idea that this using PC as a reason not to continue the dialogue, I think that that's problematic.
All right. And I'm so sorry I got to cut the dialogue off here. I want to thank all of you very much for
coming
in.
Thank you. Thanks for
having me. Really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.